Hi, everyone. I'm Carrie Cassidy from Project Camelot, and we have Tony Gosling, reporter at large, here with us today. And so without further ado, I'm going to bring him here on the screen. And just want to say he started out in the aviation industry and then was trained by the BBC. And since then, he's been working out on his own, investigating Bilderberg is one of his main areas of interest. And Tony, you can take it from there. Just talk a little bit about yourself before we launch into the whole update on Brexit and the world news.
Well, when I finished at the BBC, Kerry, where I was elbowed out in Salisbury for looking into child abuse, along with some people from the BBC also, at Wiltshire Sound in Salisbury, in the little Salisbury office by the Arts Centre, and some people from the Salisbury Journal, we were looking into child sex abuse going on in Salisbury. And at which point I was elbowed out of the corporation. Now, we since have found out that, well, one of the most famous people living in Salisbury at the time was the former Prime Minister Edward Heath. And so, although I don't think occurred to any of us at the time, it's quite possible that the trail that we were following of child sexual abuse from state children's homes in Salisbury could well have led to Ted Heath. We've since had a whole load of explosions going on for the last couple of years about that, with the Chief Constable of Wiltshire, Mike Veal, going on the record as saying he was convinced that Heath was an abuser of underage boys. There's also John Wedger, who you may have come across, former detective in the Metropolitan Police, saying that he was well known, Heath, to have been cruising looking for young boys and finding young boys as an MP, and even when he got quite high up. So it's quite clear that the police knew that he was doing this, Special Branch knew that he was doing this, MI5 knew that he was doing this all at the same time. So it was an interesting place. Although I didn't realise at the time, Salisbury was quite an interesting place to be in the early 1990s as the place of the residence of Edward Heath. So, I mean, I'm certainly looking back on it convinced now that had quite a lot to do with me finding my contract wasn't going to be renewed at the BBC. But anyway, after that, I did some campaigning to do with squatting and the land rights. That is helping organise occupations, including one of St George's Hill in Surrey, which any historians watching will know is the place where, in the English Civil War, the diggers took up residence and, I suppose, stuck two fingers up to the authorities in the politest possible way and said, we want the land back in the Civil War. And they were associated with the levellers. In fact, they were called the true levellers. And other sorts of occupations. And I've been involved in, I suppose, the squatting as an answer to homelessness, even in the city I live in now, Bristol, ever since. So probably the most interesting for your viewers and listeners now is that we do a programme, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and I, every Friday on the radio in Bristol on 93.2 FM, a two-hour politics show every Friday between 6 and 8 p.m., where we look at spend the first hour looking at all the local stories, getting local politicians on, have MPs, councillors, that sort of thing. And then in the second hour, we'd still carry on with the investigations. So, for example, last week, we were looking at the information from Kees van der Peel, who's the former head of international relations at Sussex University. Kees, a Dutch guy originally, is directly linking the Israelis to the 9/11 attacks. And he's been pilloried in many of the mainstream papers. But, of course, many of us have been working on this for years. This is no surprise. The only real surprise is that we found academics are now finding the courage to speak out about it. And there's been no punitive action by Sussex University against Kees as a result of all the publicity, which was saying, isn't this terrible? So we're still doing the investigations, Kerry, which is incredible that a little show like us, very much like you're doing, can just plow on, almost turning a blind eye to the mainstream press, which is trying its best to distract us, as we've seen with all this Brexit stuff, from any of the real points. And also the French protests across France now have spread to Belgium and to the Netherlands. And we're hearing very little about what they're really about, apparently they're all about people that don't want to pay tax. Well, it's far, far more important than that. And these people are much more sophisticated in their approach.
A very good point. All right. So we are very curious about the whole Brexit situation. Apparently, there have been some new developments. Can you get into that?
Well, look, just literally today, that is Monday, we were supposed to have a vote tomorrow at the House of Commons about Theresa May's bill. I predicted a month ago that she was not going to win it, and it seems that there is a sense of mass delusion going on within the government, that is to say within the civil service, about what is and what isn't possible. And, of course, what this does is effectively a kind of sabotage of Brexit, really, is it drives the decision further back and further back and closer to the 29th of March. We, of course, should have a deal by now. But Theresa May, because of her bungling, some would say, and I would say sabotage, has enabled the various so-called deal signings, that is by the House of Commons, for example, to be put off indefinitely. Look, there's only one way she's going to get a deal through the House of Commons, and that is if it's supported by the Conservative Party as a whole. And there's no way the Conservative Party as a whole is going to support the sort of half-baked thing that she has. Effectively, it's what the EU wanted, which is where Britain stays in the EU but in all but name. In other words, we have to still keep paying money to them. We still stay under their jurisdiction of their laws, but we don't get any seat at the table which is deciding these decisions. Although these places like the Council of Europe and the European Commission, actually the French and the German run these institutions, and most of the peripheral countries have got no say whatsoever. It's just a nice, you know, you just turn up to a meeting as Neil Kinnock did for years and years, and you get told what to do effectively by your civil servants. And so this refusal of Theresa May to allow a vote on tomorrow, on Tuesday, is really a very clear sign that she is an agent of the EU itself, that she's not really interested in trying to get a deal through, because this deal was never going to go through a month ago. But what she has achieved is she's achieved another month of fudging the issue. And it looks to me as if the only realistic option now is something like a Canada plus plus option, which David Davis, the former Brexit secretary, has been putting forward, or the simple no deal, which is actually just the World Trade Organization rules. The only trouble is, of course, that May has sabotaged the preparations for that no deal. So she's going to make it as painful as possible for us to have a no deal. And, of course, that doesn't mean that the planes will stop flying or anything like that. What it means is we go straight to World Trade Organization rules, which are pretty simple. I mean, it's the way many countries deal with many other countries around the world. It just means that there won't be any ease. There will be some tariffs on goods coming in and out of Britain, which is actually, I suppose, that's really what people voted for, just as there will be some tariffs on individuals coming backwards and forwards across into Britain from the continent and from Ireland. And the whole Ireland issue has been completely fudged, because yeah, the Democratic Unionist Party are the only party that are keeping Theresa May and the Tories in power. Without them, they don't have a majority in Parliament. And what she's done with the Irish backstop and the Irish border is she's alienated all of her Irish MPs that are supporting her, the DUP. And so right from the work, that soon as she agreed that there were going to be no border in Ireland between the north and the south, what she's effectively done is she said, oh, well, actually, Northern Ireland is more part of Southern Ireland than it is with Great Britain. And that means she's lost the support of the very MPs that are keeping the Tory majority going. So, you know, right from the start, she's sabotaged this. Of course, there needs to be a proper border if we're going to have a real Brexit between the north and the south of Ireland. Otherwise, Northern Ireland is not part of Britain anymore. And I think she's always known that. But look, there's also been a fascinating battle going on between the present and the former governors of the Bank of England over all of this. It's Mark Carney, who's the present governor, and Mervyn King, who's the former governor. And Mervyn King has come out quite squarely saying that Carney's figures are nonsense. Mark Carney's saying that it's going to be a financial disaster for Britain and not for the rest of Europe when we leave. And Mervyn King has come out last week saying this is utter rubbish, and that Carney is doing what a politician should do, not what a governor of the Bank of England would do. In other words, he's politicising the task, the job of governor of Bank of England. And I looked a bit into Mervyn King's background, and he was a sort of, I suppose, quietly spoken guy. And remember, when you're in that job, if you're a person of integrity, you've got to be very impartial. Carney hasn't been impartial. All the way down the line, he's been spinning for the Remainers, in other words, saying, oh, we've got to stay in the EU, it's going to be a disaster if we don't. Mervyn King has said the opposite, the total opposite. And I looked into his background, Mervyn King, and it turns out that he's a very ordinary bloke. He didn't go to public school. He went to his father was a railway porter back in the days when you came off the train, a porter would arrive and offer to put your bags on a little trolley and help you to the exit, to the taxi or to the car or whatever. And that was what Mervyn King's father did. And Mervyn worked his way up through the grammar school system, the state school system, up in Wolverhampton, all the way up through the financial system to become the governor of the Bank of England. So he's very much one of us. And he's also calling Theresa May's deal appeasement just as bad as the little white piece of paper that Neville Chamberlain came back from seeing Hitler with in 1939 before the Second World War started. So it's he's absolutely damning of Theresa May and this present government, which is extremely telling because Carney is the total opposite. And he, of course, was put there by Bullingdon Club boy George Osborne, gave Carney his job. And Mark Carney is one of the most devious bankers on the planet. He's straight from the Bank for International Settlements in Basel in Switzerland, where he ran the regulation committee for the whole world's financial system as a chairman of the regulation committee at the Bank for International Settlements in Basel in Switzerland, which of course is one of the banks, if anyone knows anything about banking, this is the central bank and central bank, and they were accused quite rightly after the Second World War of funding Hitler and also making foreign exchange freely available for Hitler during World War II from Basel. And the Bretton Woods Conference, the big financial conference that set up the IMF and the World Bank, actually voted for the Bank for International Settlements to be closed down. They had a vote on it and they decided to close it down, but it never was closed down. And it's still spawning people like Mark Carney. So I don't think there's any doubt whatsoever who's right. Mark Carney is basically, like Theresa May, an agent of the EU, trying to do everything they can to scupper Brexit. And also, because of his job as a regulator, it's also clear that Carney represents the 2008 bailout banksters. You know, basically the biggest rip-off in history of the whole of the Western world's public by the private banks. Yeah, I mean, again, his connection is to the Rothschild family through the Bullingdon Club and being appointed by Osborne Carney. So I think everyone really should be listening to Mervyn King. And in a way, I mean, we haven't heard very much of any sense whatsoever from Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party. Mervyn King, the former governor of the Bank of England, has become almost the leader of the opposition here in Britain right now.
Okay, now, can you tell me, you're in essence saying there will be no deal, but in essence a deal out of that. Is that what you're, if one was to summarize what you're saying?
Right. Okay, crystal ball time. There's two main possibilities here, really. I don't think a deal is going to happen because we've already seen that this deal can't go through. And also we've heard Donald Tusk and others tweeting today saying this is the only deal that's on the table. So you've got two possibilities. One is no deal and the other is no Brexit. So in other words, they may kick the can down the road even further and say, well, we can't deliver Brexit. And so we just have to stay in the EU. It wouldn't be the first time this has happened. I noticed in 2005, we had something called the European Constitution that many European countries voted on, including France, by the way. And I think the Netherlands too voted no to the EU constitution. And then, of course, it popped up the next year as something different with a different label. It's called the Lisbon Treaty. And it was slightly changed and spun in a different way in the mainstream press. And then people voted for it in some cases, but not in France. I mean, this is the cheek of the EU, is they watch referendums happen and then they ignore them. Every time, pretty much, they've ignored it. And occasionally, they've allowed a second vote, but only after a long period of propaganda, as we've had over the last 2 years since the Brexit vote in June 2016. It has been wall-to-wall anti-Brexit propaganda. I mean, things like the BBC's Question Time last week, we had one pro-Brexit person and four anti-Brexit people. And this is supposed to be the balanced BBC, in the opposite direction balancing, supposedly, to the way the people voted. So there's been a lot of spin to try and get people not to do Brexit, because this, Kerry, is a genuine political drama we're watching playing out here. And it's probably one of the most important global events for the last 50 or 60 years. Now, I would say that being British, being English, but it is the future of the Brussels project is at stake. A politically united Europe, a United States of Europe. If the British can't stop it, who can?
Okay, well, that's, yeah, very interesting. I mean, some would say that the whole thing was a ploy and they never intended it to go through. And now they're just trying to kind of fast pedal to make sure it doesn't, or at least that it's so cobbled by all the problems with hashing out the deal that this could go on for years.
That's certainly one of the possibilities with the no Brexit scenario. It will certainly drag on. But I can tell you one thing, that the sentiment in Britain is not going to go away. We've had almost a taste of blood of the beast of Brussels here. And I think what we've got right across the country now, a building head of steam. I mean, it's fascinating to see the way the global oligarchy operate, because the main force that called for the Brexit vote, and it was a growing political force in the around about the time of the 2010 elections, is the UK Independence Party. Now, that party has been quite obviously deliberately infiltrated and sabotaged. We have someone local in Bristol who's on the national executive of UK Independence Party. And what's happened is their leader, Gerald Batten, has deliberately brought in anti-Muslim racists into the party against the wishes of the national executive, and they couldn't get rid of the leader. So it's quite a deliberate attempt to paralyse the UK Independence Party. And Nigel Farage has now said just over the last couple of days that he's going to have to start another party, because that party has been taken over by people like Tommy Robinson and the anti-Islamic fringe. I mean, basically, they have all sorts of very dangerous racist connections, far-right connections, right. The English Defence League, and also connections by Tommy Robinson, by the way, Zionist-funded. Many people don't realise that Zionist foundations have been funding, for example, Tommy Robinson's legal cases. So this is a totally toxic Tommy zone that has now attached himself like a parasite to the UK Independence Party. Many of the main people from the UK Independence Party have left over the last week because they found it impossible to shake off this parasite. And that's all happened, of course, at the same time as this crucial vote, which has left the UK Independence Party almost without a voice during that crucial week. So interesting to see the manoeuvrings of the globalists in order to try and keep Britain paralysed during the time in which we need to be able to establish ourselves as the people to lead the march out of the EU. And of course, Italy is doing its best to leave as well at the moment. They're being punished by Frankfurt, the European Central Bank, Mario Draghi, for doing so. And they're finding they cannot even appoint their own ministers in Italy anymore. The European Central Bank is appointing them for them as conditions of its loans. So you've got the same exact thing going on in France as well, with the left wing and the right wing anti-EU parties starting to unite, as they've done in Italy, against Macron. And that has really kind of caught fire. I mean, literally caught fire over the last few weeks.
Well, actually, two questions. One is, where do you think Theresa May's sort of reign is going to end? And the other is to do with Paris, really, whether or not you think agent provocateurs are on the streets, basically inciting these kinds of demonstrations that don't seem to be doing very much. They're just kind of throwing smoke bombs, going back and forth. There is seems to be a lot of sentiment in Paris, a lot of people that are definitely against the government. But what I'm thinking is that this may be provoked and that they may end up with something much worse than they've even got. So it's but those two questions, see if you can.
It's easy, much easier to deal with the Theresa May question. Basically, she's been fighting Captain Kirk. And you know what that means? She's a Klingon. She's clinging on to power desperately as much as she can. And it's really just a question of whether the 40 or so Conservative MPs can send their little letters into the 1922 committee and trigger a leadership challenge. And that could happen anytime.
Anytime.
I'm afraid I just don't know. We could hear literally tomorrow that that Theresa May is going to face a leadership election within the Conservative Party. And that actually might get a new leader who can form an alliance with the Democratic Unionists to have a proper Brexit of Great Britain and Northern Ireland from the EU. And then there will be a deal, which will be virtually like a WTO deal or a Canada plus, which is what David Davis has been talking about, which is, you know, means that we do keep control of our borders and our laws, which are the two very most important things that, you know, you need if you're going to have any sovereignty. Anyway, okay, so with the Paris thing, what you were saying about it being agent provocateurs, yes, of course, there's always agent provocateurs in these sorts of occasions. But what we've seen is the French have got a really actually very, very deep-rooted tradition of slowing everything down, stopping everything happening, blocking all the roads. And actually, yes, it is quite a peaceful thing. Now, there's always going to be some far-left anarchist elements or whatever that want to set fire to everything as well. But actually, you'll find most of the fires that we've seen have either been of cars in the street in order to make barricades, or have been, you know, burning tyres and that sort of thing in the street. So, and some of the shops obviously have been attacked too, but that's mostly by the anarchists. What the French Yellow Jackets are really all about is slowing everything down and stopping the country from functioning. And the French do this every once in a while. It's just a part of their tradition. And one of the things I find so surprising is that there's been I suppose I shouldn't be surprised, knowing what a bunch of low-life, pond-life most of the mainstream media are in the West, is they just haven't been explaining what's been going on in France at all. I mean, we've had some amazing things from Macron, which haven't really properly been reported. I don't know if you've come across them. One was his speech and his campaign slogan, where he said, "Do what you want, vote Macron," which is not really an election slogan. It's basically a mind-bending slogan. And of course, it refers to, it's paraphrasing Aleister Crowley. What you want.
That's true.
Isn't it? Yes, you're right.
The actual saying is do what thou wilt, but do what you will, so to speak, paraphrased in English.
Lost in the translation, maybe, but it's basically saying the same thing.
Right.
So what paraphrasing is Crowley. Very dodgy. And of course, many people don't realize that Macron worked for 4 years for David de Rothschild's bank in Paris. Then he found himself straight into the French Treasury Department, working for Hollande, under Hollande. So he didn't have anything in between working for the bank and working for the French Treasury, which shows you the kind of person that he is. He's basically totally private banking, controlling the French government. And then he managed to find something like 3 million euros out of nowhere, just like that, in order to stand to be president. And within 6 months, he'd come from nowhere with his En Marche party in order to basically just take over because there was such disillusionment in France. But anyway, look, I thought I wanted to say that what they've done with the Yellow Jackets is they brought in actually a fascinating program of demands, and none of those demands have been being told to the rest of the public. Some of the main ones, for example, I mean, they're around various issues. One is around ecology and looking after the environment. One is around geopolitics. Another one, very importantly, is around health. So they're looking at things like vaccines as well as part of these demands, which I found absolutely fascinating. One of the really important ones, of course, is number, if you have a look at their demands, is number 9. They've got 25 altogether. And what I could do maybe is just send you a link to the Signs of the Times website, which has got a very good translation into English of what they are. And they say immediately leave the EU. They say we have had a referendum in 2005. The French people voted not to ratify the European Constitution. But then when they had the Lisbon Treaty, we were not asked. And so they're saying we are not, as far as we're concerned, in the European Union because we said no. The people said no. The government have betrayed us. So in a way, isn't it fascinating that you've got all this Brexit stuff going on in the UK? You've got all of the reaction in Italy, massive reaction against the EU in Italy going on, which isn't being reported very much. And now one of the main demands of the protesters, the Yellow Jacket protesters on the streets of France, is exactly the same. We've had enough of the European Union. This is not working for us. And, of course, anyone who's in the Eurozone, thankfully, we've still got the pound in the UK, is doing even worse because they just don't have jobs. People need jobs in order to pay the bills. And what's happening, yes, if you've got a big pool of unemployed people, is the managers and the company owners start decreasing your real wages because they know there's plenty of people desperate for a job. And you end up with taking a wage packet home at the end of the week where you can barely afford to pay the rent, you know, to put any fuel in the car if you can afford one, and to feed the family, let alone be able to go on holiday, go to the cinema, that sort of thing. So the French are quite rightly getting angry that we've got a financial system run from Frankfurt, the European Central Bank, which is destroying the lives of millions of Europeans. And Frankfurt is a very significant, I mean, I like history, and Frankfurt is a very significant city as the home of the original home of the Rothschild Bank under Mayor Amschel Rothschild, who around about 1800, remember this is just before the Battle of Waterloo, all that sort of stuff, where the Rothschilds really started making some big money by conning people, thinking that various things were happening when actually the opposite was happening, and managing to scoop up loads of shares at very cheap prices as a result. And around 1800, Mayor Amschel Rothschild sent out his four sons over the next 10 years or so to London. He sent Nathan to Paris. He sent Jacob to Naples. He sent Karl, and to Vienna he sent Solomon. And ever since, those Rothschild banks have been in those parts of Europe making big inroads into government debts and royal debts when the royal families were more powerful in the past, and basically slowly enslaving those parts of Europe with debt. And this is what they do. And of course, they've done that with countries. And of course, if you remember the structural adjustment programs of the IMF, etc.,
yes,
most of Africa has been strangled by debt.
Sure.
They started to do this with countries now, right across Europe, you know, with the bailouts, massive, massive debt. Our debt in Britain is now around about 1.6 trillion, well over double what it was when Cameron came to power, our national debt. But now what they're doing is they're starting to strangle companies, and they're starting to strangle families with debt as well in Europe. So this is their basic tool, and it's time we put a stop to it. The French have really, I think, this is at the heart of why the French people are out in the street, because they feel the pain. They feel that this government of Macron particularly is casting a shadow over society, and that shadow is a big business shadow. And that effectively Macron and his people are working for the bankers, they're working for big business, and the people who are suffering as a result are the ordinary people. We don't really have such organized traditions in other parts of Europe. The French really do. And that's why we've seen what we've seen, I think, over the last few weeks.
Okay, very good summation. What I'd like to know is whether you think Macron was stepped down.
He may be forced to. You see, one of the things that could happen is the military takeover in France. If this gets worse, and you know, around about 1,000 or so arrests over the last couple of weeks, but we haven't really seen wide scale violence against people. Yeah, so we've seen running battles with the police, but the police are fairly well defended, etc. The normal sort of scrapping that goes on in France, and this really has been happening for decades, you know, since the 1960s, this kind of thing. So I don't think necessarily Macron will be forced out except by the military. I think he's decided he's an operator, he's going to stay, and he's got all the financial support behind him. It depends, I suppose, whether or not the protesters, and many of them are, you know, sort of fairly elderly people who have just decided, well, I'm not going to get involved in the throwing petrol bombs. I'm just going to go stand out in the street and chant and wave flags and that sort of thing. And that's what they've been doing, wearing their vests. So remember, though, that we could be in a stage, particularly when it comes to the actual Brexit date, if there is a no-deal Brexit and we go over to the World Trade Organization in Britain, we could crash the pound. That, I suppose, is what the financial oligarchy would like to see happen as a way of punishing Britain. But then, of course, the pound, if the pound goes down, that could mean the euro and the dollar goes down. So remember, we've got this massive debt overhang. And again, I go back to my hero of the moment, who's King Mervyn, Mervyn King, the former governor of the Bank of England. He pointed out back in February that the West has got a £166 trillion overhang of debt. And that debt, much of it may not be payable. That's what he actually said. So that massive debt could just go crash at once. It's basically the bubble could just go bang. And maybe Brexit could trigger that. Now, many people say, oh, you've got to avoid that at all costs. Well, yes, it's going to be painful. But what's going to be more painful is we put this off more and more and more, further and further. What they did, they put it off in 2008, Kerry. They said, oh, we're not going to allow the banks to collapse, even though they're bankrupt. What we're going to do is give them a load of public money. And they then use that public money to lobby for more power for themselves. And we can't allow that to happen again. So perhaps we just need to allow the financial system to go bang once and for all, to have a proper crash, not a pretend, you know, crash, which is what it wasn't a crash at all. The bailouts to avoid a crash were in order to reset property values, reset share values to their realistic level, because the quantitative easing that's been going on ever since in Europe and America has been pumping up this bubble. At some point it's going to go bang, I would say, sooner rather than later, and possibly Brexit is what may trigger it.
Okay, I'm not sure the link up between Brexit and really the global reset is what they call it, and part of this is actually been planned for many, many years to take down the economic system as part of hyping up the sort of climate change scenario and then triggering a number of cataclysms, whatever you want to call them, around the globe. And that's kind of starting to look more plausible also in the next couple of years, leading to 2019, 2020.
I just want to clarify what I mean by that, because if we do get a no-deal Brexit, there will be, I mean, and, you know, having met some of these Bilderbergers over the years, it's quite clear this is the last thing in the world they want, because it signals the exit door is open to the EU. And there'll be many countries, including France and Germany, certainly Italy, many of the other big countries in the EU will want out of the EU at that point. And so they will be really looking to punish Britain. And not only that, it could mean a genuine lack of confidence in the pound, which might well mean that much of this debt, you see, is not just in the City of London. It's owned by people like Deutsche Bank, etc., etc. So this could be like a kind of domino effect. I mean, I don't know if you think that's possible.
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, the domino effect, you know, Cameron Fahey, he's actually, you know, sort of in a sense, dishonored himself in the process, but he was somebody who was very close into the banking establishment for quite a while and worked for them, really, his whole family did through maybe even centuries. Associated with Iraq, associated with the Kurds. And I have to say that what he said is that they had the power to take down literally a country within 3 days. So this is the kind of power that they have. Over 90% of the banks are obviously are owned and run by Rothschild. This is around the world. So, you know, with those, that kind of power over the financial system, the only other element that we haven't discussed, which I think is probably the most interesting element, has to do with AI. Because my understanding is what we really got at hand is a sort of a battle between various AIs, and there may be an overreaching AI that we're not necessarily aware of that is, as you know, is set in motion to do certain things at certain times. So this is very interesting. Where Brexit falls into that scenario is, again, another kind of interesting thing. You know, I vacillate between thinking that it's simply a dog and pony show for the people to let off steam, to let them think that they actually live in some form of democracy when they do not. And, you know, and that their vote means anything at all. I think this whole thing is orchestrated. And so we've got the only thing that's maybe out of control is the AI. And that's a very interesting scenario. So I don't know if you look into AI at all in the banking sector.
Yes, of course. The AI, I don't think, is going to be out of control. The AI is, this is I think, the way it works. Is the idea is that we are convinced that the AI is doing things just for our own good, whereas actually it's been being manipulated. So, I mean, we're quite where and when this AI is going to pop its head out, who knows? But the idea that, you know, there's even this, I mean, we were covering this on the radio recently, this church of artificial intelligence that's been set up by this ex-Google employee. He was an executive at Google, senior executive. Stephen Lewandowski, I think, something like that. Oh. But anyway, he set up this church of AI. The only trouble was that he had stolen a lot of intellectual property from Google and several other major tech companies that he'd been working for, Uber as well, I think. He was an executive for them as well. And he's now being pursued around the world for stealing all this intellectual property. And he's saying, oh, yeah, it's okay. I'm going to be the mediator of the church, of this new God. I mean, I think I think it's fascinating to look at the way this is going to emerge. But I think, you know, given that humanity seems to be making such a mess of things, even though, of course, you and I know that there are specific, basically, saboteurs, people like Theresa May, in the middle of things, messing everything up and making things as bad as they possibly can, that if an AI bot comes along and says, well, hey, guys, you know, why don't we do things like this, that they will be taken seriously, that they may well be. But then that's part of the game. It's the same way that Hitler came to power, for example, by creating economic chaos in Germany and then allowing somebody who was completely fanatical and had a totally twisted view of history and was ridiculously anti-Semitic against Jews, you know, to suddenly take over.
Well, and,
creating chaos and then appearing to try and bring order from it.
Yes.
Many normal Germans supported Hitler at the beginning, then they realized, crikey, we've been conned by this guy.
Well, I'm not so sure it was quite like that. I mean, if you go back in history, you look at the Rothschilds, you look at the Bushes, the Scherf or whatever they call them, you know, they basically were backing Hitler in the early days. And so was Churchill, for that matter. I think he's a dog that got out of control. And then they had to rein him back in. They did a similar thing with Saddam Hussein. They did a similar thing with Libya, because Libya was going in a good direction. Some people might even argue that Saddam Hussein's, at least he had there was more affluence during his time. They completely destroyed that. but he was getting out of control. So this is the, you know, they have, they do this, they put these people in power, and then they have to take them down. And in Hitler's case, it appears that he was fulfilling a certain role and a power shift that they wanted to see happen. And then he really did get out of control.
I would argue Hitler was always under control, and his controller was a man called Martin Bormann. And Bormann was the treasurer behind him, who was very carefully watching Hitler all the way through and watching him start to crumble after Stalingrad and after the big defeats like El Alamein in North Africa. And then seeing various of Hitler's friends spun out. So Hitler was totally isolated at the end. It was Hess sent on that silly flight. And it was also Reinhard Heydrich, who was the man Hitler wanted to succeed him, the butcher of Prague. And various people were spun out by Bormann, one by one, who I think was working very closely all the way through with Churchill's personal assistant, Desmond Morton, very close to Bormann right the way through the war. They were basically looting Europe, and they ran off with the loot at the end of the war.
Yes, but you have to keep in mind that all these scientists went over Project Paperclip, and they also went over to Russia, and we're also talking about Argentina and Antarctica. The Germans didn't lose the war. They're still very much in the mix. And some would say they're running things down in Antarctica with an alien race, by the way.
They're running things in Brussels.
Well, that's a whole other matter. You know, we have to also keep in mind the dark magicians, because those are very, this is a war, you know, at the top, with the various dark magicians. And they, when you say Brussels, you cannot say Brussels in the same breath without really talking about the Satanists, but especially the high level dark magicians, because they're really the ones running the scene. That is the war between Britain.
Okay, let me be really clear. What I'm saying here is that there's only one person that any politician can talk to get anything in Europe, and that's Merkel. The rest of them are irrelevant. When they talk about, oh, we're going to go and beg for another change, this, that, we're going to have a meeting, we're going to try and get another deal, that's pointless. You make one phone call to Merkel and you find out if you've got a deal or not. That's basically the way it really works.
Right. Okay. But, you know, just saying, because, you know, I have my sort of secret witnesses and this and that behind the scenes, and my sources are telling me about this sort of dark war behind the scenes. So it is, you know, and I appreciate your analysis, Tony. You're always on it. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I think we do need to wrap this up, because I said I'd keep it short. I think we've covered the sort of main playing field with this scenario. I do think...
Let me just give you one thing to play with. You know, I was talking about history. One of the things I was looking at recently was the Dead Sea Scrolls. Fascinating to see what happened with those. Right. In the 1950s, the discoveries in Qumran of these Old Testament, supposed Old Testament parchments and bits, because Qumran was where the scribes were copying, you know, as they used to, these Old Testament books, Isaiah and all these old, you know, Deuteronomy, Genesis, all these books were being copied there. And I found fascinating as a parallel between the Knights Templar and their invasions of the Holy Land back in medieval times. And they went crazy as soon as they arrived, as soon as they took over Jerusalem, looking through all the tunnels, trying to find these old documents from the Old Testament times, from pre-Roman times, and apparently they found nothing. Well, isn't it weird that as soon as the State of Israel was created in 1947, that exactly the same thing happened? They went desperately searching for these old books. And of course, the reason why is because they want to control history. They want to rewrite some of these books. And it's been almost impossible for scholars to get access to the Dead Sea Scrolls, just as it was very difficult in medieval times to get access to the scrolls that the Knights Templar had taken over and stolen. So I think we're dealing with the Israelis exactly with the same kind of thing as happened back in the Crusades, with a bunch of maniacs basically pretending to be Christian or Jewish or whatever, just simply trying to get hold of that piece of land and control history and the Old Testament, the New Testament, and the Bible, basically, which is the foundation of our culture in most of the West, certainly in Islam and Judaism and Christianity, trying to control that history as much as they possibly can, using the Dead Sea Scrolls and possibly even forging them before allowing them to come out to the public.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting line of inquiry, and I do think it could bear fruit sometime. I will say that the truth of it is that, you know, this is a story of the Anunnaki, and this is the hidden sort of elephant in the room, if you will, in Israel, and that when people talk about Israel, they don't know what they're really talking about, but that's actually what they're talking about. They're talking about going back to the time of Sumer and the Anunnaki who are still here. So that's also a very interesting.
Hang on. The Kabbalah as well, the Kabbalists.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. Sure. Key to understanding what's going on with the Israeli state right now is this so-called mysticism, the twisting of ancient Old Testament, which, of course, if you were to talk to any Orthodox Jew, they'll tell you it's nonsense.
Well, that depends on what their angle is. But rather than get into that discussion, let's close this down now and let people sort of mull over everything that we've said. It's really a pleasure to have you on the show as always. I'm so glad we were able to connect. I'm going to be in the UK from the 20th of December until the 5th of January. So if during that time you want to do an update, we'll be in the same time zone. So it's worth noting.
Wow. Okay. That'd be lovely, Kerry. God bless. Lovely to speak to you again.
All right. You take care.